Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 369 for Saturday, July 30th, 2016. I'm Tim Elliott, and I'm on with Phil Wilson.
Good morning.
And Julio Ojeda Zapata.
Good morning.
And I hear birds in the background, too, Julio.
Birds
You're
chirping.
On your porch, aren't you? You're on your porch.
I am, although I don't hear any birds here. You have amazing hearing.
It's true. No, it's coming through on the recording.
Yeah, and it sounds very nice.
Have to say our buddy Steve Borsch is taking the week off. He usually makes all these, but taking a well-deserved break. And as usual this time of year, the news is a little thin, but we did see the opening of U.S. Bank Stadium, the new home of the Minnesota Vikings. And you've got a story coming out in the paper tomorrow, Julio, right?
Indeed.
Ooh, so wait a minute. I've got to set the scene. Done. Just a second. Dun, dun, dun. An exclusive on the Minivate Gang Podcast.
Wow.
Ojeda Zapata at the U.S. Bank Stadium. So, wow. I love that. I love being the first to have that story. I know that there have been some outlets that have talked a little bit about the tech at the stadium, but yeah, nobody's going to do it like Julio. So talk to me. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, I spent a little time sort of going company by company. You know, they have a whole bunch of different companies implementing the various, you know, tech angles over there. And I talked to companies, you know, everybody from the folks that are installing the you know, the kiosks. Like if you're sitting in your seat, you know, somebody will come up with an iPad and sort of let you order food right on the iPad, you know, to the billboard, to the scoreboards, to the Wi-Fi. It's all very interesting. There's a lot of stuff to digest. So, you know, check out my story. But, you know, one of the most interesting things for me was the Wi-Fi, because as I gathered, as I did my research, apparently setting up a Wi-Fi network in a venue this large has traditionally been extremely difficult. I gather, you know, setting up one huge Wi-Fi network is hugely problematic. You'd think you could just stick, you know, Wi-Fi access points on the roof and you're done. And apparently that works very badly. And so I it was very interesting for me to learn, you know, how they did the Wi-Fi in the stadium. They actually embedded access points in the as you're going down the stairs to your seat. If you look at the railings to the left or the right, you might see some metal plates that most people won't notice them, but if you look for them, there are these metal plates that have Wi-Fi access points inside.
Interesting. So are they kind of using the railing as antennas then? Is that the concept?
No, the railing is just where they mounted it. But they explained to me, if you put it in the railing, once the game gets started and the stands are full, there are people on the left and people on the right. Uh-huh. And people are basically sacks of water. So the access point has like all these water sacks on the left and all these water sacks on the right.
Come on. You've told everybody my little pet name for my wife. Now, come on.
and they explained to me.
Sacks of water.
Sacks of water. The company that installed the Wi-Fi didn't use those terms. I am. But basically what happens is this vast stadium Wi-Fi network gets divvied up into these little mini networks because the people are sort of blocking, you know, there's one network serving the people there, but then it doesn't extend much farther. So as you look around the stadium, basically you have one vast Wi-Fi network sort of divvied up into little mini networks, which, as it was explained to me, works much better. It's much more reliable because there isn't a lot of interference, you know, from one place to another. I found that, you know, really, really fascinating. So they claim, you know, all 66,000 people in the stands could hypothetically get on their Wi-Fi at the same time and it would work.
Oh, we'll try that sucker out. We'll give that a shot we've all been at conferences where there's maybe 300 people and you have problems with the Wi-Fi. So
yeah, so they'll
1,000 will be interesting.
Yeah, a lot of claims are being made, but we'll see. And then I talked to the company that's doing the app for these guys, you know, and the app is kind of interesting because the app apparently can do everything from sort of guide you to your seats, sort of Google Map like. You can order food on the app. The app can be your ticket. Like if you're walking up to to the stadium to get in, you hypothetically wouldn't have a paper ticket. You would just have this little code on your app. And then there are these scanning devices, you know, scattered throughout the periphery of the stadium. They're called Quasars. I don't know where the hell they got that name, but they're these Quasar scanning devices. You just walk up to them, scan your ticket, walk right in. So it's intended to, you know, to make access to the facility, you know, a lot more efficient.
You talk about the use of beacons. They have a couple thousand Bluetooth beacons in there, and so that helps the navigation.
Yeah, the beacons. You know, beacons are very simple little devices. They basically detect, you know, whether you're there or not, and sort of where you're standing, kind of a thing. So they exist primarily to sort of interact with the app, so that at all times the stadium knows where you are. So it and sort of depending on when do you want to find a bathroom that doesn't have a lot of people in it, it'll guide you there. You want to find the most efficient route to your seat, it'll guide you. You know, where's the nearest food venue where you want to order food? So the beacon solve the fundamental problem of telling the stadium exactly where you are, and based on that, depending on when you do it, it sort of makes it a lot easier for you. So the beacons are kind of interesting. You know, there are beacons at the Mall of America. There are beacons at Target Field and so forth. Apparently this is several orders of magnitude greater Bluetooth beacon deployment than we've ever seen before here in the Twin Cities, which is kind of interesting.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, we came off a week of this past week was sort of their open house, sort of. Was it last weekend, I believe? Yeah. Was their big open house? Did you get over there, Tim, by any chance?
I did not. I wasn't able to get tickets.
Really? Yeah, I haven't had a chance to actually be in the stadium, and we're going to put a link in here for also Julio's camera work. He's got some 360 views and a fisheye lens slideshow put together of what's going on inside the stadium as well. That's really pretty darn good. These are great images, Julio. I'm amazed at the quality of that 360 view. It's just really sharp. But I don't really even need to go now. So,
I was there for a press event, and so they were like herding the press around. And that stadium is so huge that the guided tour of the facility took 3 hours. It was amazing.
Oh my God!
So, Julio, just before we move on, how does the tech at the U.S. Bank Stadium compare with what the Twins have at Target Field?
This looks so much better.
Well, in many ways, it's more advanced, but the folks in charge of the stadium, you know, being you know, humble Minnesotans, they were very candid with me that their goal from the start was not necessarily to make, you know, the most high tech stadium ever. You know, like Apple, you know, this is the best product we've ever made, kind of a thing. They didn't want to do that. They just wanted to make the, you know, the best technology for what they wanted to accomplish. It didn't necessarily have to be the biggest scoreboard. Scoreboards at the stadium are absolutely not the biggest in the NFL. They might be the 10th biggest.
Yeah, I think that's I saw that the 10th biggest. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they weren't like they didn't want to be like Donald Trump. You know, it just have to be the, you know, the best, the biggest, the brightest, the shiniest. But they did some interesting things, like they designed the scoreboard placement in such a way that it seems to be like nestled right in the seats alongside the fans, which sort of saves you the trouble of having to sort of crane your neck upward. So they took the tech that wasn't necessarily the most cutting edge, but they made some very interesting decisions to deploy and to implement the technology in a way that's very fan friendly. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, you know, we talk about, you mentioned Target Field, Tim, and if you've ever been to Target Field, you know how frustrating it is to get even a decent cell signal inside Target Field.
Yep.
And it looks like, according to Julio's article, Verizon has really gone overboard on trying to say that there's a really good chance. Well, I guess I don't know if they're guaranteeing it, but they expect full bars for everybody in the stadium. So which is.
But you will recall that you know when on Target Field was debuting, a lot of these same claims were being made at the time.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We'll see.
But I mean, they've got to. You know, this day and age, if you can't tweet or Snapchat or Instagram from your seat at a game, you're going to have a really bad fan experience. So I'm sure it's very important to them. So it'll be great to see this place in person. So nice. Nice. Yeah. So so check out those links. Tim, is Paulsonville going to help startups bring in more talent? So talk a little bit about that.
Well, this is a bill that Eric Paulson, one of the representatives for Minnesota, has introduced in Congress, in the House. It's H.R. 5719, and it.
If you want to do a little light reading tonight,
yeah. Right? I'll put the link to the actual bill if people want to see it. But it would enable startups to defer taxes on stock options. Of course, as you and I well know, Phil, since we both worked at startups, the employees, if they exercise options, have to pay taxes up front.
Yep.
Even if you don't execute the cash out on the option itself. So this would defer that to the end of the process, which makes a lot of sense. And hopefully this gets through the House and maybe gets into law at some point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense for where else something like this is implemented? This would be for Minnesota specifically or for the whole country.
This is just been introduced into Congress. So it would be the whole thing. It's co-sponsored by another congressman out of Nevada. So we'll see how it goes. And there's companion legislation introduced in the Senate as well.
And do you have a sense for its chances?
I don't. I just noticed it was just introduced on the 11th, and there was just an article I saw in the past week. So we'll have to track this through and see how it goes through, if it actually makes it through.
It seems like something that would have bipartisan appeal. It doesn't seem like anything terribly partisan.
You would think. Yeah. You would think that, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm such an optimist.
I know you are. You are an optimist. So I saw that Kathy Grayson had an article on the new co-working space that I guess the place is called the Reserve in Edina. It started out as Cafe Inc., according
That's
to
right.
Kathy. We've been to that space, but and now they've opened something in Woodbury as well.
Yep. So I guess it changed hands. This co-working place, because it seems like Coco is expanding and moving ahead and all this, and all the other guys that compete with them in that space, they're kind of having a little trouble here. But maybe it's just about location.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see Woodbury's got some interesting businesses going over there, so maybe there's an opportunity for people to use a co-working space rather than commute into the city. So
I see that one of you, I guess Phil, you put this in the Coco has this Google Tech Camp.
Nope, that's that was our friend Julio Ojeda Zapata. You may know him.
Tell us
about this Tech Camp, Julio. I didn't realize they were doing this.
Yeah, there's this Steve Grove guy who's originally from Northfield and he works at Google, and his wife is Iowa native, and she also works at Google, and they wanted to do sort of something on the side that sort of a give back kind of a project, and they created a tech camp for underprivileged teens, mostly teens of color. In the Twin Cities, who have an interest in tech, but they have, somewhat challenged economic background. So they set up this camp that has a variety of events, but the marquee event is they take these 16 kids. These are 8 from Minneapolis, 8 from St. Paul, 8 boys, 8 girls. They're very precise about how they divvy it up, and they take these kids on a 1-week trip to Silicon Valley. And while they're out there, they tour companies like Google and GoPro and YouTube and so forth. They do touristy stuff, but the big climax of the event is while they're out there, the kids sort of dream up, their own startup concepts, and they sort of pitch them to, so they do kind of the pitching exercise to adults. I haven't witnessed this firsthand, but I'm told by Kyle Coolbroth and some other folks who tag along that it's an amazing thing because the kids, they go into this experience, very insecure, very afraid, and it's an amazing confidence building exercise. They come out at the end of this thing, really stoked. It's a huge confidence builder for them. And the story that I posted a story this weekend because this year, this is the third year of the camp. The kids are actually headed out to Silicon Valley tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And so I talked to Kyle at Coco because he's one of the chaperones. I talked to Steve Grove, one of the founders. I talked to Chuck Olson, a visual, because one of the things they do is they periodically gather at Coco here in the Twin Cities as well and get visited, by tech companies like Jam Software and Visual and so forth. So Chuck at one point was, demoing virtual reality technology to the teens, and the teens, were understandably amazed. And Chuck tells me how he later got a call from one of the kids and said, I want to work for you. How can I get a job with you? Kind of a thing. And yeah. Chuck was, he said he was like, very honored to have this kid, so desperate to work for him. And
he said, if you don't need money, come on over.
So it was a really cute story. I really enjoyed working on it. Yeah.
That's great.
And Phil, I can't remember if we talked about this last week or if this is another acquisition. Sports Engine.
Yeah, this is another acquisition. Now they're moving into the gymnastics arena now.
Wow, they're really blowing through that NBC money quick.
Yeah, it seems to me it's like, let's go. I think since they're owned by NBC now, I'm guessing it's NBC's money to do with what they please. And, they're making that big commitment. So, yeah, I think we're going to have a segment each week now. What did Sports Engine buy this week? So they are moving through it pretty quickly, that's for sure.
Yeah. And Julio, you also did a story about cycling bags.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not at your caliber, but I enjoy a good bag almost as much as you do, it seems like, because I love some of these bags that you find.
Yeah. Well, sort of the backstory is I've been a little out of shape. I used to have a bicycle a few years ago, but it got stolen out of my garage. But then I bought a new car, and the car had a buy a car, get a free bike offer.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been bicycling again. I've actually been I've been commuting to the office because the Pioneer Press recently moved to new offices. And one of the features there that I didn't have before was a shower. Because if you're biking to work, you kind of need a shower.
Yes.
So I've been bicycle commuting for the first time in decades, having a blast, but sort of wrestling with the problem, of how to carry all my gear because I'm Julio, so sometimes
Julio, so, I got gear.
so it's yesterday I commuted home on my bike. I kid you not, with four laptops in my bag.
Oh my God.
So I needed a good bag, and a Minneapolis company called Banjo Brothers makes really nice bags. They make messenger bags, they make backpacks, and they make bicycling bags. And one of their marquee products is a convertible bicycle pannier / backpack bag. So this absolutely wonderful bag, you sort of flip, the top flap, you flip it one way. And you find you reveal the little hooks that sort of go on the back of the rack on your bike, yep. But then you can pull it off the bike and sort of flip the top flap the other way, revealing backpack straps. And this has been it's been kind of a game changer for me because now I can get on my bike and go to the grocery store, pull the bag off, throw it on my back, do my shopping, come out, put the bag back on my bike and go. I'm still a little out of shape and a little bit of a wimp. So my commute home part, there's a bus segment. The part where I go from downtown up to the St. Paul Cathedral, if you'll visualize that, that's a really steep hill.
Yeah.
I've tried that hill a couple of times and nearly killed myself. I really can't do it. So what I do is I do a quick bus ride. I throw the bike on the front of the bus. And that the bag again is great because, you know, when I'm getting on the bus, I just have the bag in backpack mode while I'm, you know, paying my fare. It's been a really absolutely fantastic product. Not the most comfortable backpack I've ever worn, but it doesn't really need to be because it's just kind of on your back, you know, temporarily. Yeah, you're not going to be
very affordable line of backpacks here and messenger bags too. So.
Yeah. So I've been really absolutely thrilled with it. It's been a real game changer, and you can cram a ton of stuff in there. Like as I said yesterday, I was like I had it kind of crammed with my clothing and my tech gear and so forth. Cool. And yeah, so I'm thrilled.
So as we kind of move off into what's happening across tech in general, you know, obviously the big story to me anyway, the big story was that Amazon's profits, you know, they inched up a little bit this year.
Yeah, only 831%.
831%.
I was hoping that they would crack 1,000%, but, you know, they fell a little short of that.
Poor Jeff Bezos, he's just barely getting by.
Yeah, I saw a funny tweet about that. They said, geez, with a guy with as much money as Bezos, couldn't he get a good toupee?
Yeah, real.
And
yeah.
I think, you know, the guy looks good at bald.
Go with your embrace your baldness.
That's right.
But yeah, this was based, I guess, mostly on their web services division, the AWS stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's like everything now is, you know, we've moved a lot of our stuff to Amazon. And I think that it's just going to keep getting bigger for them.
So. Yeah, it is. And they're, you know, of course, expanding here in the local area. So the.
Yep.
Their regular e-commerce business and shipping goods to your house, whether it's a couple of days or whether it's a few hours, is really, you know, just moving ahead. And they're expanding
that drone delivery in the UK too, I noticed.
Yeah,
so.
Apparently they've got some regulations in their favor there in the UK.
Yeah,
which does make sense because really it's like a big state. The whole, you know, whole island is. Like a, you know, reasonable size state here. So you can, and most of it, most of the people live down in near London area. So, you know, it's probably a lot easier and logistically a lot easier to start someplace like England and kind of move out from there. I think they're going to see a lot of regulatory problems here in the U.S.
Yeah, probably so. Just as we're talking about Amazon and just a sort of a preview of upcoming events, I've noticed that Amazon Minneapolis Splash is coming up on Wednesday, the 10th of August, which is at the McNamara Alumni Center. It's for technology people in the tech world here in Minneapolis to check out Amazon. Sort of, it looks like it's a big recruiting event, basically. So,
And there's one other Amazon angle, the Shakopee Fulfillment Center, which we've heard a lot about, actually started operations this past week. And they, Amazon sent me a bunch of high resolution photos, which are kind of interesting.
It's a great looking campus down there. Yeah.
Yeah. If you watch my site, I'm going to post those very shortly this morning. Cool. So,
can you drop a link to that down in the notes, Phil, for that?
I'll do that.
For that event?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll do that.
Yeah. Oh, it's already in there. Yep.
Oh, okay. I didn't see it.
Yep.
And we see our friends at Microsoft are laying off more phone people.
Yep.
So, Julio, what's your read on Microsoft in the mobile phone business? Are they totally out, or are they retrenching?
My sense is it's kind of a lost cause because virtually no new significant app that comes out ever comes out for Windows Phone. The you know just to give you one example, the Minnesota Vikings apps and the companion US there's a companion app for US Bank Stadium if there's like an event that's not Vikings related. So there are these two sort of mirror apps made by the same people that are one is Vikings themed, one is not. This is just one example of an app that routinely comes out for iOS and for Android, but not for Windows Phone. I can't recall the last time there was a major app release of any kind that had you know the Windows Phone representation. It just never ever happens again, and that right there, you know, tells you the platform is pretty much done for. Microsoft, you know, will probably keep making Lumia phones as kind of a prestige thing, just to sort of keep it around, because there's rumors of a, making air quotes here, Surface phone. I don't know if that will come to pass or not, or whether that'll make any difference. And so Apple just, I'm sorry, Microsoft, just out of pride, will probably just keep making handsets, but they have negligible market share. It's just, it's a lost cause at this point, I think.
Well, would they pivot and just, you know, continue to support both iOS and Android with apps, and that becomes their mobile phone strategy?
Well, they are doing that. This past week, for instance, they released an alternative to the stock Apple camera app. They released a very nice camera app that has some AI built into it to detect faces. It's very basic, super basic app, but it has the face detection. It has the hyperlapse, you know, the hyperlapse feature where if you're shooting video, everything gets automatically smoothed out and stabilized. So it's a very simple app without a lot of bells and whistles on the surface, but it has some of these cool Microsoft technologies underneath. And they just released that for iOS. They haven't even released an Android version. So they are, in fact, very extremely aggressively releasing stuff for Android, for iOS, exactly the way Nintendo should be doing, you know, with its intellectual property. They should be releasing apps, you know, right and left. So Microsoft, that's something that Microsoft has with their new CEO has been doing very aggressively in the last few years. It's a good move because, you know, back to the original point, their own phone platform is basically nowhere.
Right.
So
right.
another week, and we didn't talk about the first hack last week because I think it didn't happen, but we have another hack.
Monday we got the release on the first hack, and now we're already onto the second hack for the Democratic Party. So
yeah, so this one is the Clinton campaign, and we haven't seen anything come out through WikiLeaks or anybody else, but apparently the Justice Department is looking into this. This is a worrying trend, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, you look at if it is truly related to Russia as a country doing the hack rather than, I mean, because we know a lot of the Baltic states and Russia have are sources for, you know, hacking shops in general. So, you know, it's hard to say that for sure that it's tied to the government. But if governments start toying with the election process and our political machine, it's going to get even more difficult. So,
yeah, that's for sure. And of course, WikiLeaks put out the DNC internal emails and voicemails earlier in the week, which really kind of marred the convention and caused a lot of controversy. So it looked like the DNC was in the bag for Clinton the whole time, which didn't make Bernie Sanders supporters very happy.
No, and you know, it cost W. Wasserman Schultz her job. So.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a little bit
overdue anyway. But anyway.
Yeah. So Julio, you had a comment?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, although I think the overall effect of that was relatively muted in the long
really
run.
Was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Monday it had a big impact. But I think after Monday, it sort of and that insanely insanely great Michelle Obama speech. It's like, okay, well, that was great. So it kind of, I think that put the DNC back on track. But yeah, it's still an issue that needs to be dealt with. So,
So I think that Steve, even though he's absent, put this Bruce Schneier fear yes. porn thing from Vice in here about the Internet of Things will turn large scale hacks into real world disasters, talking about infrastructure hacks like dams and power grids and tunnel ventilation systems and the like. Is this getting you guys worried?
The Internet of Things area is my sense is it's being implemented in a highly scattershot fashion. There are many competing platforms. There are many products, some of which haven't really nailed down the security. It's not a highly standardized unified field like the PC industry is now. It didn't used to be. There used to be so many competing computer platforms. Now, you know, it's down to just one or two or three. Security on those has been nailed down. We're at a point with Internet of Things that's very similar to the early PC industry years, where it's very disorganized, very decentralized. A lot of people throwing, you know, technology at the wall to see what will stick. And security seems to be an afterthought in many cases. And it's going to be a long slog to get this all nailed down. And in the meantime, you know, some fairly nasty things could happen. So I am somewhat concerned, and I am quite frankly rather cautious about what Internet of type things I install in my house. Like, I'm fine, you know, installing, you know, Google Nest products. I'm relatively confident in doing that. I'm a little less confident about installing, you know, products from smaller, lesser known companies, because I just don't know if they nailed on the security. So I tend to be very leery about that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's one area that Apple really hasn't done much, and they do have a, you know, HomeKit APIs, but really we haven't seen a lot of activity directly from them in that mode. So it'll be interesting to see what they have in store for us in the future. So, let's see. So another thing you had this week, Julio, was your how to watch the Olympics, which are, of course, coming up on Friday. Without cable.
Is it Friday already?
Yeah.
Really?
God, the opening ceremonies are coming up Friday. Yeah.
Oh. Me without my Zika.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I'm really glad I don't live in Puerto Rico.
Well, it looks like, you know, judging from the news, you don't want to live in Miami right now either. So.
Yeah, Puerto Rico is my homeland. I love it dearly, but God, I'm glad I live in Minnesota. But, The Olympics, Comcast, you know, fun fact, Comcast and the Pioneer Press are in the same building. So if they like want to give me a tech demo, I just hop in the elevator and go down a couple of floors, which is kind of cool. And they ushered me into this this room with this huge screen to show me their X1 system Olympics features. Like if you're a Comcast subscriber and you have the X1 box, I mean, there's a ton of really cool stuff. It's all really integrated. You can find things with voice commands. You can favorite your favorite players. I mean, you can do a crap ton of stuff, and it's really, really cool. It's one of the things that is intended to sort of keep Comcast subscribers loyal. But I'm always this close to, like, cutting the cord. You know, the one thing that keeps me from doing that is my wife, who just loves her X1 box dearly. If she weren't in the picture, I'd cancel that in a millisecond. but this always gets me to thinking, you know, what are the alternatives? And there's some interesting options for people that don't have cable. Like if you're just doing the rabbit ears, obviously you can get NBC over the air. So my article sort of went into a little bit of a discussion about what kinds of indoor antennas you can buy. There's one Channel Master antenna that worked really well for me. And then if you get broadband, you know, from Comcast or from wherever, if you have broadband but you don't have cable TV specifically, there's Sling TV, which now works through the Apple TV. Sling TV is basically a cable-like service. You get a lot of the same basic and premium cable channels, but you get it from this company that is not a telecom company. Its content is delivered straight over the internet, but it has some of the same deals with all of these networks. And so you can set up your Sling packages depending on your interests. You know, there are world news packages, there are Latino packages, there are sports packages. So if you select your channels wisely, you can get almost all the Olympics coverage that you can get through Comcast, if not necessarily with the same degree of integration and ease of use, but you can get practically everything you can get from Comcast on Sling. And you can get Sling on your laptop. You can get Sling on your phone, on your Roku, on your Apple TV. I mean, there are many, many options. And Sling, I've written about Sling from time to time over the years. It used to be very badly designed, very clunky to use. It has come a long, long way. The X1 box, I think, is the jewel of user friendliness. you know, everybody badmouths Comcast, but nothing is slicker or easier to use than the X1 box. I always say that, but Sling is making great strides, and it works fantastic. It has HBO. I watched the John Adams miniseries, you know, the other night, and it's a great way to get your Olympics fix if you just have broadband in your home but no cable TV service. And then there's something similar called PlayStation View. PlayStation View is a Sling like service from Sony that works on your PlayStation, but not only on your PlayStation, you can also get it on your computer, on your mobile device, and so forth. So that's another really good option.
PlayStation View has more channels, so they're more expensive than Sling is, because Sling is what, $25 a month, something like that.
That's a very good question. I didn't do a careful channel count, but they're roughly comparable.
Yeah.
Okay. With Sling, you can get different packages. You can get your blue package, your orange package, depending on which packages you get, it sort of determines how many channels you have. It's the same thing with PlayStation, but with both services, if you get everything, you have several dozen channels. You get a lot of channels. You basically can replicate your cable service at a savings. Even if you get, you know, all the bells and whistles from Sling, you're still, I believe, paying less than you would for cable, which is why I'm you know, constantly tempted to cut that damn cord if my wife would only let me.
Let's see, real quick, I noticed we didn't have anything in here about, I did want to comment that we had a visitor in the office this week from our New York office on the revenue side, and they're talking about, I don't know if you guys saw that BuzzFeed is actually handling the Snapchat for the Olympics.
Really?
So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, so they actually are covering that angle for, it's a part of the NBC Universal deal with BuzzFeed. So wanted to point that out. And then we didn't really talk about Pokemon Go this week. So did you, and I know this story broke earlier in the week, which was that Nintendo recently admitted it won't really directly profit from the augmented reality game that was built by what, Niantic. After Pokemon Go went out, the value of Nintendo went up like $7.5 billion. Well, they lost 6.7 of that as soon as they said, we're not going to really make any money on that.
Well, they didn't. They had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they licensed.
Absolutely nothing to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I found that interesting.
Well, I'm sure they make some money from the licensing, wouldn't they?
But they didn't have a specific. Nintendo has come under a lot of criticism for consolidating, concentrating its intellectual property on its own hardware, and everybody tells them to do a Microsoft and to release iOS games, to release Android games, and then a lot of people were sort of mistakenly saying, "Oh, finally, Nintendo is listening," and they, you know, finally released an iOS game. They actually did not. They had nothing to do with it. It was entirely Niantic's doing.
Yeah,
and it's basically Pokemon Go is basically just kind of a fluffy, cute layer over a pre-existing game called Ingress.
Yes.
So Nintendo still, you know, has to sort of get with it and start releasing its own.
I think it's like, and I believe it's so for the licensing fees, if I look at these numbers correctly, whether that's $800 million, they still made a good amount of money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But have you guys talked about, I wasn't on the show the last couple of weeks. Has this Pokemon Go thing come up before or something?
Oh yeah. Every week.
Okay. But when Pokemon Go came out, I quite honestly wasn't paying a lot of attention to it. But a couple of my colleagues at the Pioneer Press with kids were saying, Julio, they were kind of like, kettle prodding me, saying, "Hey, Julio, you need to write about this." This was the Sunday where the whole thing was exploding. So on Monday, I hit the ground running at the Pioneer Press. And the following week, in fairly short order, I think I wrote six different Pokemon Go stories, including one with where I went out playing with my son, kind of a thing.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was fun. So I at least temporarily my job title at the Pioneer Press changed to Pokemon Go correspondent. So
there you go. Yeah. Well, I mentioned it in the podcast a couple weeks back that, you know, I think in the BuzzFeed trending feed of 10 stories, I think 7 or 8 of them were Pokemon Go related. So yeah, that really blew up very quickly. So, well, let's talk about the cool thing of the week. Tim, Why don't we go ahead and start with you, brother?
All right. Well, I'm interested in these smartwatches, and this week a new smartwatch called the Tick Watch 2 came out, and it was interesting because it's an Android Wear-powered smartwatch that's on Kickstarter, and it's only $99. So
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Most of the Android Wear smartwatches are, you know, over $200 or $200-$300 in that time range, time scale, or price range. And for $99, that's looking pretty attractive. It's got all the features. It looks pretty good. It's got a GPS built in and a heart rate monitor and all the stuff you would expect from a smartwatch that costs hundreds of dollars more. So we'll have to keep an eye on this and see how it progresses. And they blew past their goal, so this will actually get built at some point.
At some point. Yeah, that's great.
The only issue that I have with this, and this extends to the Apple Watch as well, is all of these tend to only last for a day, and I would much rather have a watch like the Pebble, which lasts for a week.
Right. You know?
And that's kind of the Achilles heel for all of these, in my view.
Yep. Yep.
But can't you just drop it in the charger at the end of the day? Or?
Yeah, but I don't know.
I like to sleep with my watch. So.
Yeah, no, okay. I wear a Fitbit all the time, and it lasts for about a week, about 6 days. And, you know, you keep it on the whole time. It measures your sleep and all that kind of stuff. So if I get a smartwatch, I'm going to want to use it the same way that I use my Fitbit. And hopefully it replaces the Fitbit, so I only have to wear one device. So
right. What do you think of the new Pebbles that are coming out?
I think those are very interesting. I'm going to take a hard look at those when they hit the market later in the year.
Although I have to say, of all the smartwatch platforms, Android Wear is far and above my favorite.
Oh, really?
It fits me very well. I find it very intuitive, very satisfying to use, for reasons that, and I can't quite put my finger on why, but the Apple Watch, I have an Apple Watch and I've been using it, forever. I still can't compel myself to like it. It just doesn't feel very useful. It feels clunky. It doesn't deliver the information in a seamless way that really appeals to me. And Android Wear, I'm a big Google head, so maybe that's part of it, but I just love the Android Wear operating system. I just haven't been really happy with the hardware. Like I was playing with a Motorola version at one point, and the screen, you know, in relatively short order, started degrading, got this sort of this yellow tint along one edge. The fit and finish of the hardware, and the overall quality of the hardware has been lacking. There's not that Apple level quality I have found, but the underlying operating system itself, I just absolutely love it. That's just me.
Huh.
All right. My cool thing this week is, I think we've talked about this in the past, and you know, ultimately we're going to recycle some cool things every once in a while because they could become cool again because I needed it. This Shugru, I don't know if you've used Shugru. This. Shugru? Is it Shugru?
Because it's like sugar, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Shugru, which is a self-setting rubber kind of glue sort of thing.
We can build things, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, because I'm starting to get, you know, cracked cords from, you know, Apple devices and things like that. So I had to get some of that. And I just really love this stuff. And it really works very well.
So they sell that at like Target, Walmart, any kind of place like that? Or you have to buy it online?
I'm not sure. I always buy it online, but I buy a lot of stuff online. So what can I say? I wonder if something like a Micro Center would have it or something like that, though.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe so.
They've got a lot of stuff. So, Julio, you have a cool thing of the week?
Yeah, I'll add this to the show notes. The gadget that I've been playing with that I absolutely love dearly is my favorite case for the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, and by extension, the iPad Air 2. It's a Zag case called the Rugged Book. We were talking about my biking before, and I carry my iPad everywhere. It's absolutely my default mobile computer, but I've been a little leery about tossing my iPad into my pannier bag. And I no longer worry about that because I'm using the the Rugged Book. The Rugged Book is a case that it adds some bulk to the iPad by necessity, but it's so it's a sort of rubberized plastic thing that is so protective that you can literally toss the iPad across the room, or in my case, I could just literally thrown it into the bag. It's protects against liquids and so forth. So it's highly protective case, but it's also very flexible. It has four viewing modes. You can sort of use it in a laptop mode, or you can lift the display up and then flip it around to turn it into sort of a video stand mode. You can remove the keyboard portion entirely, kind of use it as a tablet, or you can flip, keep the keyboard part on, but sort of flip it to the back to sort of hold the whole thing in one tablet reading mode. But very, very flexible for a lot of different situations. Very protective. It has a backlit screen. The keyboard itself feels fantastic.
Yeah. And looks so like around around $100. Kind of looks like it. Kind of looks like Julio. Kind of looks like it turns it into what you remember the. I don't know if they still make those, the Panasonic Toughbook or
yeah.
It kind of looks like a little version of that.
It's exactly the same as the Toughbook, and they still do make those Windows laptops.
Yeah.
That comparison hadn't occurred to me, but you're dead on. It looks very, very, very much like that. And it's initially I struggled with how much bulk it added to the iPad, but it the 9.7-inch iPad Pro isn't that big, so it's not really that much of an issue. And just adding that degree of protection, sort of makes it worthwhile. And so I have used a MacBook in the past. I don't really want to carry a MacBook around anymore, because this is the whole package. I like having a touchscreen. I like being able to do iPad-y stuff that you can't do with a laptop. Yeah. But at the same time, when required, this is a very more than serviceable laptop experience. So this is my default. I love the iPad itself, and with the Rugged Book, this has become my default mobile workhorse computer. I never walk out the door without this in my messenger bag or my backpack or whatever. It's always cool with me, because I know nothing will ever happen to it.
Very cool.
Yep.
Okay. We talked about the new addition to the upcoming events, which was the Amazon Minneapolis Splash event coming up on the 10th. Check that out. And when we... We'll see what else is happening over the next week, and I bet you we'll talk about it on
the Minivate Gang podcast.